This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. Neil Conan's out today. Tomorrow, John Bolton is expected to be confirmed as the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. In the month since his nomination hearings, Bolton has sat at the center of difficult investigations, most recently controversy centered on Bolton's heavy-handed and allegedly abusive management techniques. But beneath the spicier story of office politics, the question of whether Bolton is the right person to collaborate constructively with other countries, and how his leadership style might further the administration's goal of reforming the U.N. His critics have cited Bolton's past hostility toward the organization, like the 1994 speech in which he said there is no such thing as the United Nations. But his supporters argue that his bold and perhaps abrasive techniques could be assets in dealing with a large and at times indecisive organization such as the U.N. In the end, what is the role of the U.N. ambassador? Can Bolton effectively fill it? The Senate Foreign Relations Committee will vote tomorrow on the nomination. What do you think the next U.N. ambassador should do? What qualities do you think he needs? And is Bolton the right person for the job? Join us. Our conversation here. Join the conversation at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email address totn@npr.org. First, what does it mean to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations? Ambassador John Danforth currently is a partner at the law firm of Brian Cave, LLP. He's the most recent holder of that job, and he served as ambassador between June of 2004 and January 2005. He joins us by phone from his office in St. Louis, Missouri. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so let's say you had to appoint the next ambassador to the U.N. What qualities would you look for?
Well, I think that that's the president's choice, and that there are all kinds of different personalities that could hold the job. I don't know John Bolton. I think I've spent 15 minutes of my life with him, so I don't have any opinion one way or another on him. I do think that the United Nations is important. I think it's important to the United States. I think it's important to the world. It clearly has its problems. A lot of people spend a lot of time criticizing the UN, and I'm sure for good reason. But for all of its faults, it's a very useful institution. And I saw that even in the short 6 months or so that I was there, that there were occasions where the United Nations could play unique and positive roles. There were other occasions where it was just sort of a cave of the winds, but the Security Council in particular is a very useful place.
Well, what about this style, this notion of an abrasive style, kind of cut to the chase approach at a place like
the... I honestly don't want to get into commenting on an individual.
We won't talk about him, but let's talk about what you do at the United Nations. What is that? If you had that style, would that be a style you'd recommend at the United Nations?
I'm sorry, I just really don't want to get into the Bolton debate or the...
What works at the United Nations? What makes an effective diplomat at the United Nations? How do you work effectively in that environment?
Well, let's think about what the United Nations can do and where it has been an effective institution. Examples. Well, one was with respect to Sudan, and a lot of attention in the Security Council when I was there was paid to Sudan, both the so-called North-South peace process and the issue in Darfur. There were differences of opinions within the Security Council. There are 15 members of the Security Council. There are differences of opinions. And yet there was a real effort on the part of all the members of the Council to come up with common positions, with positions that everybody could support. That was good. During the U.S. presidency of the Security Council in November, the entire council went to Nairobi for the Sudan peace talks. It was only, I think, the third time that the Security Council had met outside of New York City, so it was an extraordinary event. But there's no doubt in my mind that the presence of the Security Council in Nairobi was a significant part in marshaling world opinion in behind a peace agreement that was, in fact, signed 2 months later. Another example was the issue of Syrian troops in Lebanon. We passed a resolution. It was very hard going. We had the bare minimum votes in doing it. But I think that resolution put some weight on the scale of eventually getting Syrian troops out of Lebanon. So it's an opportunity for countries with very different points of view to try to formulate positions where they are in common positions, where probably no country is totally satisfied with the resolution, but the resolution does form the basis of a consensus.
What is, when you talk about forming a consensus, it's a slow process. There's a lot of frustration expressed in the United States about how slowly things go, and certainly an international consensus may not be in the best interest of the United States. How do you operate in that environment? Is it, do you have to sort of, in a sense, if you're the United States, throw your weight around, suggest that you can go it alone, so, you know, this is our position? Or how do you operate in a consensual environment like that?
There's a lot of wordsmithing. A lot of very earnest effort to try to put together language that everybody can agree on. And when you think about the wordsmithing, it at first blush, it seems sometimes ridiculous. But when you think about it further, it's an indication of the lengths that countries will go to try to reach agreement. For example, the Security Council passed a resolution calling for Syrian troops to leave Lebanon. We got that resolution passed, as I said a few minutes ago, by the bare minimum votes. But the only way we got it passed was to agree not to use the word Syria in the resolution. Sounds ridiculous if the purpose of the resolution has to do with Syria, but that's the kind of verbal compromise that made it possible to get the resolution passed. With respect to Sudan, we wanted to pass a resolution threatening the imposition of economic sanctions against the government of Sudan. China, among other countries, but especially China, which has the veto power, would not allow us to use the word sanctions. So instead we use the word measures, which means the same thing, but it's just providing sufficient verbal cover so that countries with different points of view can come together on one resolution.
All right, Ambassador, well, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks.
Ambassador John Danforth is the most recent U.S. representative to the United Nations and is currently a partner at the law firm of Brian Cave, LLP. Joined us by phone from his office in St. Louis, Missouri. Bolton supporters argue that his plain-spokenness and experience as a former Undersecretary of State for Arms Control are particularly well-suited to protecting U.S. interest and pushing for reforms at the U.N. Ruth Wedgwood is a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University and joins us now by phone from the campus in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What qualifies John Bolton?
Well, he's a very smart guy. He was a summa from Yale College and he graduated from Yale Law School. He's had a long experience in government, both as the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division under President Reagan and the Assistant Secretary of State for international organizations under the first Bush administration, which, by the way, is a job very much like the ambassador's job, where you worry about the kind of delicate wordsmithing that Senator Danforth just spoke of, where you pass upon drafts and look forward to options, very much involved in UN reform even then. So I think he's had a deeper immersion in the building and in the institution than almost anybody one can think of. I think there's a huge cost to keeping the seat open and vacant. Ann Patterson, who's the number two in the U.S. mission to the U.N., is a wonderful civil servant. Everybody admires her. But there's a limit to what a career person can do. You do need somebody in the job, particularly, I think, as a partner for reform with Kofi Annan, who is a political appointment, who has connections to the White House, and who'll be working for Condi Rice, but who's seen as somebody with political credibility.
Well, getting back to this business of wordsmithing and the sort of the time and the difficulty in dealing with some of the silliness that goes on, can a man who's made the kind of statements Bolton has about the UN be seen as a credible player once he gets there?
Well, I think people should go back and read that pair of observations he made about the 10 stories and the no such thing as the UN. Read the full colloquy. It was a panel discussion with John Anderson of the World Federalist Association and a woman from Pacifica Radio and a person from the Cato Institute. And in context, if you take these as attempts to capture something in a metaphor, I think they look much more reasonable. John, for example, if you read the full transcript, said, let me tell you about a somewhat radical proposition. He said, there's no such thing as the UN. There's simply a group of member governments who, if they have the political will, every once in a while, to protect international peace and security, they're able to do it. The truth that speaks to is that the UN is inevitably dependent upon coalitions of the willing, countries that are willing to step up to the plate as volunteers and enforce UN mandates. There's nothing in the UN Charter, even though it's thought of as a collective security organization, it really isn't, because there's nothing in the Charter that pledges, at least the Charter as it operates, that pledges governments to contribute military assets for the enforcement of international law against victims. And in that sense, it really is true. There's what there is alliance politics, well done, well crafted alliance politics. And if you can cajole your allies to contributing to a military expedition, then you can protect a victim. Otherwise, not.
Ruth, you mentioned reform a couple of times. What kind of reform does the UN need?
Well, I think that the most important thing for folks thinking about the UN is to realize that if you support the organization, which I very much do, as with Senator Danforth, that you want it to be effective and that its purposes and its ambitions can't be wholly separated from its effectiveness. I'd have an inspector general in every agency so that people who see something that's not in accordance with our own idea of fiduciary duty could have a place to go. I'd make it more transparent with a Freedom of Information Act. I'd think about using the model of funding even that we use for some of the agencies we like best, like UNICEF and the Human Rights High Commissioner and the Refugees Agency, which is voluntary funding, and therefore allowing the funders to have some kind of oversight of the program.
All right, Ruth, we're going to take a break right now, and then we're going to come back, talk more about John Bolton at the UN. His appointment comes up before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee tomorrow. We'll take your calls. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. We're looking at the arguments on both sides of the debate over John Bolton, President Bush's nominee for UN ambassador, and what his confirmation might mean for the future of the United Nations. You're invited to join that discussion. Is John Bolton the right man for the job? What makes a good UN ambassador? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, email address totn@npr.org. Our guest right now is Ruth Wedgwood, a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University. Let's go right to the phones. Eric is on the line from Guilford, Connecticut. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
You have a question or a comment for us?
Well, a comment. I think that John Bolton is an unfortunate choice, not so much because I'm privy to really what his work has been, but I think that I take it as a symbolic choice that someone who's been so outspoken against the United Nations and take such a hard line was a signal to the world about the way that American foreign policy is intended to run.
All right, let's get a comment. Ruth Wedgwood, what about that? I mean, given what he said, is this more of the U.S. go-it-alone point of view, and does that send that message to the rest of the world?
Well, I take it as a kind of realism about what the UN can do and what it can't do, which was very much the position of inside the House by the late 90s and of the Democrats as well, that you shouldn't expect more of the UN than it can deliver, that there's no automaticity to it, that you should be aware that peacekeeping forces, for example, will often not obey the UN force commander, that you have to go to the national capitals to get permission to move them 10 kilometers up or down the road, that you shouldn't expect impossible things of an organization that by its structure is going to have limitations, that it's not a substitute for other forms of national security, even as you respect and recognize its huge importance in norm building, in giving a place for negotiation, in leveraging U.S. forces by soliciting other countries to contribute to peacekeeping.
Eric, thank you very much for your call. Another issue is what many perceive as his propensity, again, as we talk about unilateralism. He talked about the International Court of Justice. He called it a pretend court. He was very happy when the U.S. withdrew its signature from the International Criminal Court. Now, the U.S. seems to be moving in the other direction, and I guess the real question here is whether John Bolton is on his own. He's working for the administration now, right? So does it really matter what John Bolton has said about these institutions?
No, the ambassador to the U.N. is not a cabinet position. The ambassador works for the Secretary of State, and I think some people who've held the job in the past have been slightly dismayed to discover that they have to clear all their statements, that when you're negotiating in the Security Council, you are back on the phone to Washington all day long, seeing what the NSC and the White House and the State Department think. So this is very much a team effort. This is not a one-man band, no matter who's filling the chair.
So how much do you think John Bolton or anybody can accomplish in that position?
Well, I think the most important thing right now, because I think the U.N. is really feeling in its cups. Oil for Food has been the last disappointment after a string of disappointments of Bosnia and Rwanda and the failure to protect U.N. employees in Iraq, that what you do need is a hard-headed realism about the institution and what's wrong with it and what's right with it. And Kofi Annan now has just a limited period of time. He has a year and a bit to go. He's hoping to put together a reform package for the fall. Many of the coalitions will be formed this summer. Having a vacant chair there is not helpful. And I would just point out to some folks that John has been active in a number of things. For example, PSI, the Proliferation Security Initiative, was a effort of 60 countries, which he put together and deserves, I think, great credit for, trying to get cooperation in interdicting the shipment of WMD material by sea. And it was done on a consent basis with no radical doctrines of law, and ultimately then gave rise to a very, very important Security Council Resolution 1540, which calls on all countries to pass national legislation to control WMD precursors.
Ruth, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Ruth Wedgwood is a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins University. She joined us by phone from the campus in Washington, D.C. Well, his supporters call John Bolton plain-spoken and direct, terms that his critics translate into heavy-handed and abrasive, and argue his techniques are not suited to the post. Joined now by Steve Clemens, senior fellow at the New America Foundation and publisher of the weblog thewashingtonnote.com. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
So you heard what Ruth Wedgwood had to say. He's been very effective diplomatically, and he's the perfect guy for the job, or at least a good person to handle that.
Well, obviously, Ruth and I have some very serious differences. She's a great lady and a thoughtful person here in town, but I think she's read Mr. Bolton's profile quite wrong, and there's a bit of myth creation about John Bolton that's so at odds with his record. Mr. Bolton is known for having sabotaged a great amount of diplomacy in the State Department. Richard Armitage had a team of people there, the Deputy Secretary of State, had a team of people specifically assigned to try to keep John Bolton within bounds because he so regularly crossed under beyond bounds. We have notes that he modified memos that were going to Colin Powell, even to Condoleezza Rice. And there's been a lot made of the abusiveness that he brought to this job. Jack Danforth wouldn't comment on that, but one of the things that was implicit in Ambassador and Senator Danforth's comments was that this is a job that requires a lot of nuance. And I tend to be one of these people who's dumbfounded by the White House's view that they want theatrical abuse and theatrical sort of displays of behavior, whereas I would imagine that the most effective kind of ambassador is someone with private resolve, private capability and effectiveness, who in a public way can help smooth over those kinds of things that Danforth was talking about. There's nothing nuanced about John Bolton. In fact, there's quite a bit wrong.
Well, perhaps in the public persona, but there's maybe that's part of the game. Part of the game is to show the world one face and then behind the scenes be an effective collaborator. And as Ruth Wedgwood suggested, he's been at the foundations of some of these diplomatic efforts since the first Bush administration.
Well, in the case of PSI, which Ruth mentioned, the Proliferation Security Initiative, there's a this is an ad hoc group, but it was also interesting that Senator Pete Domenici, a Republican from New Mexico, Senator Pete Fitzgerald, a Republican senator from Illinois, asked Senator Lugar a couple of years back if they could actually testify against John Bolton's performance in his job because they felt that he was delinquent, that he was not, in fact, securing Russian nuclear materials and dealing with other major national security threats that were part of his portfolio, because he was both off on private crusades that may have to do with ideological predispositions that he had, or that PSI is an overblown, ineffective, unverified kind of ad hoc arrangement. The two major accomplishments of which are listed as Libya, which was really being managed by a great number of other people, and the second was rolling up the AQ-Con network, which Richard Armitage, John Wolfe, and George Tenet were actually the primary drivers. There was actually a State Department commentator who said that when AQ-Con was being rolled up, Bolton was quite oblivious to the facts. So there's a bit of massaging of reality here.
800-989-8255 is the number to call. John is on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I think one thing that we need to take in consideration is that John Bolton will not be establishing any position in the United Nations, but will actually be working as our representative, our agent. And I personally view the United Nations as a large negotiating table. And quite frankly, I would rather have someone who comes in not completely sympathetic to everything to represent my part in any negotiation. As you remember, the Soviet Union did an excellent job of that in the 60s. They were abrasive. They were rude. They were very strong on being antagonistic. And yet they were able to get many nations to their point of view simply due to the fact that most people they were negotiating with realized that they were going to be a hard sell. So therefore, when I want to look for someone to represent me at a negotiating table, I want someone who's going to be a hard sell.
All right, thank
you. And that's all I have to say. I'm about to lose you guys anyway.
Okay, thank you, John.
Bye-bye.
Steve?
Well, just quick comment. I think the caller makes a very good point. And, you know, it occurs to people like me that there are other candidates in the administration. Paula Dobryansky comes to mind, who's currently the Undersecretary for Global Affairs, who's just as much of a skeptic of the UN, a tough-as-nails negotiator, no pushover for anyone, who I could tell you would be confirmed in a week, carries great relations with the White House, Republican leadership, used to direct the Washington Office of the Council on Foreign Relations. She would make a stunningly good candidate. The question, the real game going on here is not that John Bolton is a great guy for this job. The White House counted on the American public not paying attention to this position and thinking John Bolton was not a high-profile character. It was a cynical judgment of a number of people who wanted to keep John Bolton in the mix, but Condoleezza Rice did not want to have this man as her deputy. So he got shuttled off to the UN. It was a cynical judgment about the UN, and now people are trying to cover up what was, I think, a rather poor decision, a questionable decision, because there's a great line of other Republicans that could have played a greater role. And I think that the miscalculation has been that people didn't expect John Bolton to become a household name. And it's the abusiveness and these sort of personal stories and vignettes which have driven such awareness of Bolton and concerns about him.
The other side of the critique is that it sends his critics will charge that sending a guy like him to the UN reinforces a picture by the rest of the world that the U.S. is a go-it-alone maverick nation that doesn't want to play along with the international family. On the other hand, the supporters might say, well, we need to project that image. This is the post-9/11 world in which our security cannot be, you know, put in the hands of other nations. We have to take control ourselves. That is the message to send.
Look, I take President Bush at his word that when he went to Europe after his recent election, that he wanted to re-engage the world, begin uniting our allies again and dividing our enemies, rather than what we seem to have been engaged on was uniting our enemies and dividing our friends. And he wanted a fresh start. I believe in American interests being pursued as much as any other sort of patriot. I, however, sort of see a real problem in the notion that America can do it all alone all the time. And I think your phrasing of this is absolutely right, that there's sort of a league of people who think we can do all things and perform all things without paying attention to the costs. That's not true. The world's great insoluble problems require partnership, a collaboration, and we need to build those alliances better. And John Bolton's the wrong person for that.
Let's go to Jim on the line from San Francisco. Hello, Jim.
Yes, hi. This is Jim. I just wanted to say this. I've been a lifelong Democrat, and while I am not happy that President Bush is the president of the United States of America, he has every right to nominate who he wants to, especially for a post like this. And I think the Democrats are really spinning their wheels, and for that matter, the moderate Republicans, when they should really be calibrating, you know, nominating and all of those, you know, advising consent issues for judicial nominees. John Bolton, hey, he may be, you know, he may show a lot of animus towards the UN, but he, you know, I don't see any problem with that. I just, that's the bottom line for me. The president should be able to nominate who he wants to, especially
right.
for a post like this.
Let's get a response. Thanks, Jim.
I think it's also part of the responsibilities of the Senate, of civil society, and of our democracy in general to encourage the president to know that he occasionally makes mistakes and he can do better and hit a higher mark than he's hit with the John Bolton nomination. So in part, this is an encouragement to the president to say, you know, this man was reckless with intelligence. This man try to stovepipe and cherry-pick intelligence, which actually harmed American national security. He was delinquent, and we have more nuclear and proliferation problems today than when he began his job. That if you look across a broad palette of concerns that people have, some people are concerned about workplace ethics, others like me are worried about recklessness with intelligence and national security. There are a lot of other concerns as well. This is not a man with impeccable credentials that all Americans can feel proud of, and we can hit a far higher mark, and we should, for such a vital role, and it is an important role in terms of the foreign policy portfolio of this country, that it's not just a low-level ambassador. This is another major pedestal and punctuation point in defining American foreign policy. And John Bolton has never shown himself. I'll just mention, you know, Brent Scowcroft, who's not taken any public comment, gave a great lecture recently at SICE, where Ruth Wedgwood actually works. He gave the Dag Hammarskjöld lecture, and Scowcroft said that, you know, he admires John Bolton, that he's a smart man and knows a lot about the UN. But then with a rather wry voice and cryptically said, what matters most with John Bolton are the instructions he's given and whether he chooses to follow them. And the room burst up laughing. This is not a man who likes to follow instruction. And I think that we ought to try and encourage the White House to step back and say, well, we've got Pola Dobryansky. We've got, you know, Rob Portman, who was a great choice for the U.S. Trade Representative job. We have other people in our bench that would have been the sort of impeccable credentials and a person that Americans could feel proud of.
We're talking about John Bolton's nomination to be UN ambassador. My guest at this hour is Steve Clements, senior fellow at the New America Foundation. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stachow, sitting in for Neil Conan. Steve Clements is a critic of that appointment. Earlier on the program, we talked with Ruth Wedgwood, a professor of international law and diplomacy at Johns Hopkins, who supports the measure and the move. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. Bill is on the line from Cleveland. Hello, Bill.
Hello. My whole concern about this Bolton issue revolves around the Bush administration's entire character of corruption. I mean, Bolton himself was involved intimately with what is now being what is now turned up in England of the Bush administration's manipulation of intelligence to support Bush's intent to go to war, and we're asking, or rather, the Senate is asking for information about Bolton from the State Department, which is being denied to them by the State Department, which they think is critical to them making a qualified decision on advising consent, and they just won't release it.
All right, Bill.
To have faith in them.
All right, let's get a response. Thank you, Bill.
Well, the caller has raised the 900-pound question in this, is that the Senate has a responsibility of oversight, and there are some vital intercepts, what we call National Security Agency intercepts, which are the country's most secret secrets. There are also some important exchanges that the caller referred to, an email where John Bolton and his chief of staff, Fred Flights, were engaged in essentially punishing the State Department's Intelligence and Research Bureau for not generating intelligence products that fit what John Bolton wanted. And there's quite a lot of this that's gone back and forth, and the State Department, as the caller said, is not giving this. What's important to remember is that in John Bolton's testimony at his confirmation hearings, he denied that any of this went on. This is something that's lost behind all those people. He said that he had never tried to fire anyone. He said that he had never had any arguments with people about the substance of intelligence, but rather had problems with management practices or people going behind his back. And on that level, we already have a serious degree, a disparity between what the research and investigation by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff has yielded and what Mr. Bolton's testimony was on the first day of his hearings. And what the caller is talking about in terms of the British revelations and others, and there's quite, I mean, there's a huge mound. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of interviews. And what also is rather historic about this particular case is you have eight senior government officials from the State Department and from the CIA who were Republicans, high-level Republicans, or who have been confirmed by a Republican Congress, who've come out. I mean, we have two former Assistant Secretaries of Intelligence, Colin Powell's Chief of Staff, former Ambassador to South Korea, former Deputy Director of the CIA, the former CIA Deputy Director of Intelligence, all have come out behind this. And as well, people like Colin Powell, Brent Scowcroft, and Rich Armitage, while keeping their powder dry publicly, are doing quite a bit privately, in my view, to raise questions about Mr. Bolton.
Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Steve Clemens is Senior Fellow at the New American Foundation, publisher of the weblog WashingtonNote.com. When we come back, we will take a look at what kind of recognition is usually reserved for the mafia. This is Frank Stacio on NPR News.